Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Good Eater, A Vegan's Search for the Future of Food, by Nina Gilboa, narrated by Nina Gilboa. For Dedushka. With each meal, we make choices that help or harm the planet. What shall I eat today is a very deep question. Thich Nhat Hanh. Introduction. The Vegan Wave. A generation ago, hardly anyone knew the word vegan, much less knew what it meant. For those who had heard of the term, the image it conjured was likely of a stereotypical, black-clad, tattooed, pierced animal rights protester bloodying fur coats with red paint at a fashion show. Or maybe a hippie restaurant like the one in Annie Hall, where Alvy Singer orders a plate of alfalfa sprouts and mashed yeast. Cue the unappetizing smell emanating from the bulk section of the health food store, where soy milk was sold as a chalky white powder and veggie burgers look like something astronauts would grudgingly eat on a space mission. But in the last decade, veganism has undergone an almost unimaginable cultural makeover. The word vegan is everywhere. There is the little V certifying your favorite brand of cookies, the cruelty-free label on lipstick made with fruit pigments, and the option to choose vegan pleather for the interior of the latest hybrid car. From refined to hole in the wall, restaurants are declaring their commitment to animal-free menu options. From beet tartare at fine dining establishments to the McPlant burger. The popular image of the herbivore is becoming less stigmatized, too. The stereotypical activist evangelizing the animal cause to passersby has been eclipsed by the ethereal influencer posting the perfect avocado toast on social media. A seemingly endless line of celebrities credit plant-based diets as the secret behind their glowing skin or sudden weight loss, and world-class athletes praise their meat-free regimens for giving them an edge in performance. The coffee shop down the street now offers a selection of milks made from plants, not only a much improved version of the vintage soy, which actually resembles milk, but also almond, oat, coconut, and even hemp. Vegan burgers, which used to be found in the specialty or health food sections of grocery stores, now compete for your attention at the meat counter. These products are made of peas, potatoes, fungi, or even seaweed, but through the magic of food science, they are now virtually indistinguishable from conventional animal products in blind taste tests. Even a global pandemic didn't slow down this trend. While the meat industry struggled with record numbers of COVID-19 cases among its vulnerable slaughterhouse worker populations, plant-based companies ramped up production in the midst of ingredient shortages and supply chain disruptions, and their investors shelled out billions in capital despite the coronavirus choking global financial markets. In the pandemic year of 2020, more than $2 billion was invested in plant-based products, making up nearly half of all capital invested in the sector in the last 40 years. The venture capital enthusiasm for alternative proteins mirrors demands from consumers. In 2022, the U.S. retail market for plant-based foods was worth $8 billion, up 7% from 2021, despite a challenging economic climate. The global market is expected to grow exponentially, reaching up to $95 billion worldwide by 2029. While plant-based milk is now a staple in many households, there's a tremendous growth of interest in other food categories too, especially alternatives for meat, cheese, and eggs. More than half of American households now purchase some kind of plant-based product, and the vast majority come back for more. Meanwhile, new technologies are transforming how we produce food, in ways unimaginable even a decade ago. Already, scientists are using novel bioengineering tools to make cruelty-free animal products like milk and egg whites, some of which are already available for sale. The next decade will also see the debut of meat grown directly from animal cells, what advocates call cultivated or cell-cultured meat and detractors call lab-grown meat. Although the jury is still out on how accessible these products will be in terms of both cost and availability at scale, if these companies succeed, we may witness a true paradigm shift in food as we know it. These cultural currents, along with documentaries exposing the horrors of factory farming and fishing industries, the nutritional benefits of a whole food plant-based diet, and the havoc animal agriculture is wreaking on the planet have led to a seismic shift. Whereas the numbers of strict vegetarians and vegans remains at about 5% of the U.S. population, a quarter of Americans and as many as half of Europeans are cutting down on animal products for health and environmental reasons, and consumers want even more vegan options than are currently available. They might call themselves flexitarian, forgoing meat on Mondays, eating vegan before six, in the words of the former New York Times food columnist Mark Bittman, or embracing the memorable words of the food writer Michael Pollan, "Eat food, not too much, mostly plants." Clearly, veganism is no longer the niche subculture it used to be. Once in the shadows, it's now in the cultural limelight. That raises the question, what happened? I'm not the person you might expect to tell the story of how veganism entered the mainstream. My parents weren't hippies, and I ate plenty of meat and dairy earlier in my life. I was born in the Soviet Union in a tiny country called Moldova, landlocked between Romania and Ukraine, to a modest family of Russian, Ukrainian, and Jewish origins. Growing up in the rubble of the collapse, we didn't have much choice about what to eat. As a child, I remember hearing stories from my parents and grandparents about the long lines for basics like milk and bread. My father routinely woke before sunrise to stand in line for a jug of milk that he manually churned into cottage cheese. In the summers, my grandparents rented a trailer by the woods and foraged for mushrooms, not as a hobby, but out of necessity. As the days grew colder, they'd spend days canning, preserving, and carefully storing food for the long, harsh winters. When I was 7 years old, we won the golden ticket, a chance to try our luck at the North American dream. After applying to various countries, we were accepted as immigrants to Canada, mostly because its immigration system selects for those with higher educational backgrounds, and both my parents had been working on doctorates in physics. They were forced to drop out when the Soviet Union collapsed. When the Iron Curtain was drawn back, it revealed a people hungry for the Western way of life, including its food, and our new life in Toronto meant a world of delicacies opened to our inexperienced palates. At the grocery store, I marveled at the seemingly endless array of fruit yogurts, whole aisles of potato chip bags, gigantic racks of barbecued ribs, sugary cereals, tubs of ice cream in every flavor, and muffins, pies, and cakes made ready to eat. Costco especially left an impression. More food than I could ever imagine under one roof, and a fridge at home big enough to store it. I used to roam the aisles as my parents shopped, unable to fully comprehend the abundance before me. The cornucopia was a revelation, and we quickly adopted the Western diet without a second thought. Yet like many immigrant families, we continue to eat the familiar foods of our homeland, and Russians don't shy away from meat and dairy. My taste buds still awaken to memories of borscht, beet soup with smetana, sour cream, blini, crepes, tvorog, cottage cheese, syrniki, cottage cheese pancakes, pelmeni, meat dumplings, plov, a meaty rice dish, kolbasa, sausage, and salate, salads made of potatoes, peas, pickles, eggs, ham, and mayonnaise. Russian food is an odd mix of peasant fare inspired by French cuisine, but in giant portions. My fondest memory is of a layered custard cake named after Napoleon, a treat my babushka would make for special occasions. That's why when I was a teenager, we were shocked when my father suddenly announced that he wanted to be a vegetarian. My dad grew up in an obscure village in a country nobody had heard of, and yet for years, he had apparently harbored a desire to give up meat. When he took up yoga and meditation to deal with the intense pressures of immigrant life, he felt a kinship with the Indian philosophical principle of ahimsa, nonviolence, which preaches vegetarianism. Odd pucks of faux meat appeared in our freezer. Large tubs of mixed nuts filled the cupboards, and soon my dad was putting a weird green paste on his toast, which I found totally off-putting. This was way before avocado toast became a trendy thing. Our Russian friends, of course, made fun of him, teasing him with remarks about loss of manliness and warning that he would never feel satiated again. My dad wasn't sure he'd manage the transition, but he decided to give it a try out of moral principle. My sister and I got on the bandwagon mostly because we admired his convictions. My mother, as well as her parents, who lived with us, as in many immigrant families, eventually had no choice but to accept the dietary divide in our house, a Berlin Wall of opposing food ideologies. my poor babushka now generously cooked two separate dinners. For many years, my vegetarianism wasn't a big part of my identity. If anything, I gladly compensated for the lack of meat in my diet with a hearty serving of dairy, yogurt, ice cream, and especially cheese. My love affair with cheese blossomed when I went to France for the first time at 17. Like countless cliched Francophiles before me, I strolled the Parisian streets, sampling every funky and creamy concoction. Who would deny themselves such pleasures? My mother used to say, "Vegans don't enjoy living," and your average French person would wholeheartedly agree with her. But as is often the case with big life changes, a personal tragedy unexpectedly shifted my attitude. At the time, I was a couple of years into my graduate program in sociology at Harvard University, and I decided, rebelliously, to ditch Cambridge for the south of France while I studied for my general exams. I bought a one-way ticket to Nice, where I rented a tiny studio apartment on the outskirts of the city. In between study sessions on the rocky beach, I strolled the streets of the old town and blissfully, for ignorance truly can be blissful, I enjoyed all the gelato, brie, and pastries I fancied. Then, one day, my father called me. My grandfather's cancer had taken a turn for the worse. My beloved dedushka was the wise old grandfather of storybooks. I had seen him last over the winter break after he had a medical emergency over Novy Год, the Russian New Year. Rather than celebrating, I spent the holiday cooking meals, shuttling between hospitals, and translating doctor's orders. I will never forget the dreary yellow of the walls, which contrasted so distinctly with my own feeling of vibrant health, while spending days in waiting rooms. We thought he'd turn a corner, but now, my father said over the phone, he was gone. The loss of our dedushka was devastating, and yet, as those who have experienced grief know, sometimes a glimmer of hope emerges out of the darkness. My grandfather's passing was the catalyst that inspired me to research the link between diet and disease, something I had never bothered to do before. What I found rocked me to my core, offering a glimpse of another reality where my whole family might have made different food choices and where my dedushka might have enjoyed more years of good health. I learned that nutritional research had long shown that those following a plant-based diet have significantly lower rates of mortality for major diseases, lower body weight, even compared to health-conscious meat eaters, and longer lifespans. I learned that only 5 to 10% of cancers are attributable to genetic defects, which means that the vast majority of cancers are rooted in environmental and lifestyle factors. That includes breast, prostate, colorectal, endometrial, gallbladder, and pancreatic cancers. In fact, there is strong evidence to suggest that a diet of exclusively or even mostly whole plant foods can treat and even reverse disease, including cancer. In 2015, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, IARC, the cancer research branch of the World Health Organization, WHO, reviewed more than 800 scientific papers on cancer and declared that there is sufficient evidence of carcinogenicity of processed meats, bacon, salami, sausages, beef jerky, ham, and such, putting them in the same category as tobacco smoking and asbestos. They also declared that unprocessed red meat from cattle, pigs, sheep, horses, goats, and so on is probably carcinogenic to humans. The IARC used the word probably since the evidence on the carcinogenicity of meat is based on observational studies. Meat does contain certain important nutrients, including protein, vitamin B12, and zinc, but these important nutrients can also be obtained from a healthful diet of plant foods that have been shown to contain compounds that protect against cancer and other diseases. Whether or not dairy is carcinogenic is a hotly debated topic. There is evidence both for and against its consumption, depending on the type of cancer. One of the clear links is between consumption of dairy products and increased likelihood of prostate cancer, the type of cancer that took my grandfather's life. The mechanism appears to be the hormone insulin-like growth factor 1, IGF-1, which is present in both low-fat and high-fat dairy and is linked to the proliferation of prostate cancer cells. In a study comparing meat eaters, vegetarians, and vegans were found to have the lowest levels of IGF-1, but otherwise normal hormonal levels. Incidentally, vegan men were found to have higher testosterone, which builds muscles and increases sex drive, flipping the narrative around meat eating and virility. How is it that this information was not widely known? It seemed purposely obscured by powerful lobbies working on behalf of the food and pharmaceutical industries. Reporting by the Center for Responsive Politics has documented that the 30 food and beverage companies that spent the most on lobbying in 2020 collectively spent almost $40 million. Meanwhile, a report published by a prestigious medical journal showed that from 1999 to 2018, the pharmaceutical and health product industries spent $4.7 billion, an average of $233 million per year, on lobbying the U.S. federal government, $414 million on contributions to presidential campaigns, and $877 million on state candidates and committees to influence healthcare laws, drug pricing, and regulation. In other words, both food and healthcare, like other big business, cast long shadows over the political landscape. It seemed diabolically unfair, and I wondered what other truths lay buried beneath the perverse incentives. As the prominent physician Dr. David Katz eloquently expresses, a food supply in which junk is a food group willfully engineered to maximize eating for profit is tolerated with no obvious outrage by either parents or health professionals. Waiting for silver bullets, we let a pernicious truth hide in plain sight, squandering the potential to eliminate some 80% of chronic disease and premature death, and at the same time devastating our aquifers, our climate, our economy, and the great treasure of this planet's biodiversity. That summer, I went down a rabbit hole. Slowly, I learned many disturbing truths about the food system, including the outsized impact of the animal agriculture industry on climate change and chronic disease. I educated myself about the overuse of antibiotics on factory farms, a potentially cataclysmic problem that creates treatment-resistant bacterial strains that could be a catastrophic blow to modern medicine. Unlike many of the most zealous converts, I didn't embrace the vegan lifestyle overnight. For me, it was a gradual process, two steps forward, one step back, until one day I found myself on the other side of an impossible divide, and I could no longer ignore the consequences of what I put on my plate. Although my new knowledge couldn't save my grandfather, it forever changed my life. When I came back to my graduate program that autumn, I declared to my professors that I wanted to understand how veganism, long a niche subculture, was turning into a mainstream movement. My well-meaning mentors objected, pointing out that if I wanted an academic job, I'd better pick a topic that would appeal to more than just vegans, still a tiny fraction of society. They were right, of course, but I ignored their objections. I couldn't imagine a topic more important than the one that touched on many of the biggest social issues confronting my generation, including climate change, social justice, chronic disease, and food security. I could sense the vegan wave cresting, and I wanted to be there when it hit shore. Eventually, my committee gave in, and I was lucky enough to secure funding to research this growing movement around the world. My research took me back to France, the epicenter of gastronomy, to Germany, the European leader of the vegan renaissance, to India, with its deep history of vegetarianism, and to Israel, where I lived in an urban ecological co-op and witnessed the incredible rise of veganism in that tiny, complex country. Eventually, maybe inevitably, I landed on the California coast, first in Los Angeles and eventually in the Bay Area, to study the epicenters of veganism in the United States. All told, I spent over 5 years doing fieldwork and interviewing, in three languages, hundreds of people at the forefront of this massive cultural shift. On my travels, I met every kind of vegan there is. Righteous activists defending the lives of innocent animals, iconic influencers embodying the aspirational, health-conscious vegan lifestyle on social media, fitness gurus proving that plants can power ambitious athletic performance, documentary filmmakers, authors, and podcasters spreading the word, visionary founders revolutionizing food technology in Silicon Valley, and deep-pocketed investors supporting their mission to end animal agriculture. At first, I was starry-eyed. I was especially inspired by the entrepreneurs and even attempted once or twice to drop out of grad school and start a company that I believed could change the world. Academia has a politically incorrect term for this tendency, going native. It means losing one's scholarly objectivity and embracing the worldview of one's research subjects, and it comes mostly from anthropology. Be careful not to drink the vegan Kool-Aid, my advisor repeatedly warned, implying that I was at risk of joining some kind of cult. She probably sensed I was already a lost cause. Yet as I broadened my network and dived deeper into the vegan community from all its angles, I began to sense some of its internal friction surfacing, especially at the boundaries of my various vegan friend groups. There were the animal rights activists I met in Boston, Paris, and Tel Aviv, who toiled in underpaid jobs at charities to save as many animal lives as they could, committed to raising consciousness and expanding the moral circle. There were my social media influencer friends in Los Angeles, who followed strict health-conscious diets and eschewed any processed foods. Perhaps most charismatic were my biotech enthusiast friends in the Bay Area, who started alternative protein companies they hoped could change meat itself. All these groups were under the umbrella of a movement to change the future of food, and yet many had different and often opposing ideas about how to get there. To be perfectly honest, I didn't identify with the bleeding heart activists. My concern for animals was mostly intellectual. It seemed obvious that it was morally wrong to cause suffering to sentient beings, especially if we didn't need to eat meat, but I wasn't the type to go out of my way to visit an animal sanctuary and hug a cow. At the same time, I couldn't fully comprehend the moral calculus of my purely rational vegan friends either, those inspired by effective altruism. Many of them started companies to make products that could compete with animal agriculture. I felt fully aligned with their mission, and yet when I saw some of their products, I couldn't help but experience a pang of disappointment that despite the claims on their packages, they couldn't necessarily be considered healthful, and an unhealthful diet is now responsible for more deaths globally than any other cause, including other lifestyle factors like smoking or lack of exercise. Still, I told myself, even though these foodstuffs belong to the category labeled processed foods, they must be better than the status quo factory-farmed items they were designed to replace. For me, these tensions came to a head when at last I defended my dissertation and moved to the Bay Area to begin a postdoctoral fellowship at UC Berkeley's Sustainable Food Initiative, where I planned to turn my research into this book. There, I was surprised to meet many food movement advocates who were, to say the least, skeptical of the new vegan products on offer, if not downright derisive. To them, the Impossible Burger did not herald some Silicon Valley techno-utopia where we could have our meat and eat it too. In their view, some of these new products made of genetically modified soy sprayed with herbicides reinforce the very same values, efficiency, uniformity, and cheapness that uphold our industrialized fast food system. Others expressed skepticism of a movement that was turning a philosophy with ancient and often radical origins into a glamorized lifestyle. They argued that such a shift represents a tone-deaf ignorance of deep cultural traditions tied to humble beginnings all around the world and excludes those who have been eating plant staples for generations. They wanted a future in which we return to our roots and even right back to the land, where we grew our own food, ate seasonally and locally, and cooked our own meals rather than expecting corporations to feed us. There were undeniable truths in all of these points of view, and I found myself trying to reconcile them. I became increasingly frustrated by the exaggerated claims of CEOs who knew how to tell a good story, but didn't, it seemed to me, take the time to think deeply about true systemic transformation. But I felt equally irritated by self-proclaimed food experts who were concerned only about animal welfare or about their personal health, rather than thinking about our collective responsibility to sentient beings and to our home, the Earth. Many assume that since animals have always been a source of food for human beings, there couldn't possibly be anything wrong with that anthropocentric equation. Today, we're collectively waking up to the reality that the most pressing problems we face – deforestation, water shortage, loss of biodiversity, chronic diseases in developed nations, food insecurity in developing ones, antibiotic resistance, and even pandemics – are tied in some way to the large-scale industrial production of animal products. Even so, many unanswered questions remain. Can our concerns for the fates of animals be addressed through behavioral change alone? Can we shift the food system without sacrificing convenience, affordability, and taste? Is capitalism the only route to systemic transformation? Can veganism be reconciled with the realities of feeding a growing world population? Can veganism scale without sacrificing its values? As I wrestled with these questions within myself, I realized that the journey at the center of this book wasn't only, as I initially thought, about the transformation of a movement, but also about my own inner transformation. While the book is centered on the tales of those at the vanguard of veganism, as well as their critics, it's also about how meeting these changemakers shifted my own views about the future of food, and it might just shift your own. In this book, you will discover the philosophical roots of veganism, which trace as far back as antiquity to famous advocates like Pythagoras, Leonardo da Vinci, Leo Tolstoy, and Gandhi. You will learn about the modern animal rights movement and how the failure to raise consciousness led to a paradigm shift that changed culture. You will walk through the headquarters of Silicon Valley startups innovating the future of food through novel technologies, including meat made of plants and real meat made without slaughter. And you will get an insider's look into the wealthy vegan mafia bankrolling the whole enterprise. You will learn the true meaning of regenerative agriculture and learn why its advocates often critique veganism, and meet a farmer trying to balance her commitment to both philosophies. You will learn about the path-breaking nutritional research showing the benefits of a plant-based diet for both health and longevity, and how chefs are making vegetables irresistible. And you will learn the often ignored yet essential radical roots of veganism, including the African diaspora. Along the way, you will savor meals and learn to make tofu from a tofu master that will make you reflect on your own answer to the question that inspired this book. Is there truly an ethical way to eat? My own journey to answer this question led me to an entirely different place than I initially expected. At the outset of the book, I had been a diehard vegan on a mission to convince others of the value of my perspective, yet one who came to it from the perch of a rigorous academic. At the end, well, that's part of the story that you will hear in this book. For now, let's just say that my position is far more nuanced and complex today than I ever expected. The Good Eater is a deeply researched story of the cultural transformation of veganism and the changemakers behind it. But it also turned out to be a personal account of my own search for how to eat and my attempts at reconciling the different visions I've encountered along the way. It is my attempt to, as Rainer Maria Rilke advised the young poet and a mentor at UC Berkeley advised me, be patient toward all that is unsolved in your heart and try to love the questions themselves. This book is the story of the search for what a just, nourishing, and equitable food system could look like and for my place in cultivating it. Chapter 1. Setting the Table. If man is seriously seeking to live a good life, the first thing from which he will abstain will always be the use of animal products, because it involves the performance of an act which is contrary to the moral feeling, killing, and is called forth only by the greediness and desire for delicious food. Leo Tolstoy. There is no definitive beginning to the history of veganism, but one good place to start is the year 1944. In the midst of the most destructive war of the century, a British man named Donald Watson was trying to come up with a new word. He wanted it to evoke a lifestyle in harmony with the planet, non-human animals, and personal vitality. At first, he entertained benivore and sanivore from the prefixes bene, meaning well, and sani, healthful. Not quite right, he thought. He then considered emphasizing the food to be avoided with dairy ban, but that seemed too hard line. The term vitan seemed possible, evoking vitality. With a nod to the French, he briefly considered bon mangeur, good eater, but nothing quite clicked. It was his wife, Dorothy, who landed on the winner. She suggested combining the beginning and ending of the word vegetarian, veg and an, equals vegan. The term made sense since the Watsons saw veganism as a natural extension of the philosophy of vegetarianism, which espouses the non-consumption of animal flesh for moral, health, environmental, and spiritual reasons. On a sunny Sunday in November, the Watsons and others met at the Attic Club in Holborn, London, to officially found the Vegan Society. But why, if the Vegetarian Society had already existed in England for a century? The Watsons and their friends held a strong conviction that the definition of vegetarianism had become muddled. It had originally referred to a diet that excluded the use of animals in any form, but over time it widened to include those who still consumed eggs and dairy products, confounding the meaning. The first vegetarian cookbook, called Kitchen Philosophy for Vegetarians, published in 1847 and coinciding with the creation of the original society, included no animal products, and many of the founders of the Vegetarian Society avoided animal foods entirely. Yet some within the early society came to see these rules as too extreme. While a stricter diet was acknowledged as the ideal, the members felt it alienated those who could not go all the way. As the magazine editor for the society wrote, "We feel that the ideal position for vegetarians is abstinence from animal products, and that most of us are, like other reformers, in a transitional stage. In the early 20th century, there was a lot.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?